a long time about on it during this talk. The next hindrance is Tinamita, sloth and torpor. I mentioned something about that last night. The sloth and torpor is another aspect of ill will, because it's just a way of escaping from the task. We just go into sort of this dull, woozy state. We don't really experience the pain of existence so much, but we're not experiencing the pleasure either. After a while, the sloth and torpor you will find is not valuable at all. It's not worthwhile. It's just wasting time. And even though that prisoners in jail, as I said yesterday, have the saying, an hour extra sleep is an hour off the sentence. In life, you can say, an extra hour's sleep is an hour off my life. Can you afford to abandon so many months, so many years of your life? Though I worked out some time ago that if, on average, if people sleep 8 hours a day, an extra hour's sleep is 1/16 of your life thrown away. If you live 80 years, that's 5 years of your life thrown away. Instead of sleeping 8 hours, you just sleep 7 hours a day. You actually gain 5 more years of life. Not just years tacked on at the end, when you're so weak and sick and old, it doesn't really matter, but quality years. If you just sleep 1 hour less every day, it's the equivalent of 5 extra years of life. Wouldn't you like to have more quality time, quality years in your life? So this is why that sloth and torpor, you're just wasting so much time, so much opportunity. All Buddhist traditions say that the human life is so valuable, so precious. And especially a human life where you've met like the Buddhist teachings, you met the Dhamma, you have the opportunity to practice. Then you don't realize just how many lifetimes and how much merit you've had to do just to get here. It's not just paying, what is it, $240 or $50 or something to get here. You paid lifetimes of karma to get into this meditation retreat. So don't waste any moment of it in sloth and torpor. And as someone once told me, and it's what I keep on repeating, in sloth and torpor, it's like going along a road. You come to a fork in that road. To the left leads to sloth and torpor, to the right leads to peacefulness but full awareness. Sloth and torpor always arise when you take that left turn, that left fork in the road. Explaining it that way, being mindful, you'll know what I mean. There is a point in your meditation where actually you choose to go into sloth and torpor. Basically you give in. And if you can just see that point, you can avoid going on that left fork and go to that right fork, which is far more pleasant, peaceful, but awake, but aware. That fork again is where you're about to let go of the doer, but you also give up the knower as well. The right fork, you let go of the doer, but you keep the knower. Fully aware, but doing nothing. Fully aware. Beautiful rest, free from doing. It's a beautiful thing to experience. That's sloth and torpor. Again, you don't get anywhere in sloth and torpor except just wasting time. The next hindrance is restlessness and worry, which is one of the subtle ones. So worry, again, is part of guilt. More like the doubt about guilt, where you're concerned, did I do this right, did I do this wrong? But the main part of that hindrance is the restlessness of the mind. And that restlessness of the mind is always due to the fact we do not appreciate the beauty of contentment. We do not appreciate just the sheer pleasure of doing nothing. That we have a fault-finding mind. rather than a mind of gratitude, which appreciates what's already there. This is a training which I deliberately do in my monastery. Usually every Monday is after the weekend. Mondays is supposed to be a day we don't do any work at the monastery, a 3 day of meditation. I always try and go on a walk around the monastery, not just to check up on all the things which need to be done next week, but just to look at all the things which have already been done. Not looking for faults, but looking for the results of all the hard work which has been already achieved. So completely looking at the monastery in a different way. Other times I have to go around looking at all the things which need to be done. It's the opposite of the fault-finding mind, which is what we've developed in Western society, and in Eastern society as well. It's like looking at the government, looking like Mr. Howard. Instead of all the things he does wrong, deliberately looking at all the good things which he's done, and all the service which he's given to the country. Gratitude, rather than fault-finding. I don't think there's a paper in this country who doesn't write articles from the fault-finding mind, rather than the grateful mind. And if this restlessness you want to overcome, the fault-finding mind will give you so much ammunition for restlessness that you'll never be short of faults in what you're experiencing right now. And if what you're experiencing right now is not perfect enough, you'll go somewhere else. Going somewhere else is called restlessness. Going somewhere else, anywhere else except here, is restlessness. Staying at home is the opposite. How can you stay at home? Only if you can appreciate the benefits and the comforts of home. Only if you can appreciate the benefits and the comforts of this present moment, of this meditation object you're experiencing right now. If you have a fault-finding mind with the breath, and that's your object, the breath will never be comfortable. You can hold it there through willpower. If you haven't got contentment with what you're doing, eventually the mind will go somewhere else. It'll be restlessness. It can't stay with the breath. You're pushing it onto the breath, but it won't keep there because you're doing it the wrong way. The way to overcome restlessness is the appreciation of contentment. Change the way you look at this moment. Instead of looking at it, looking for the faults, looking for what's wrong with this breath now, what's wrong with this body now, what's wrong with this retreat center now, what's wrong with me right now. If you look at it that way, restlessness is caused. If you look at it in contentment, isn't it wonderful that I don't have to do anything now? Isn't it wonderful that I don't have to give a talk in a few more moments? Isn't it wonderful I don't have to do any building, I don't have to please anybody, I don't have to be smart and funny? Isn't it wonderful I don't have to do anything right now? It's appreciating contentment. All I've got to do in the whole world, this is how I think very often, all I have to do in the whole world, in the whole universe, in the whole scheme of things, is just to watch this wonder happening now. It's just so easy to do. Nothing else is demanded of me at all. It's so much easier just to watch one breath than to talk with the Shah of Serpentine Jaradal about a gravel pit, or figure out how to sort of teach this crazy monk in the monastery about how to behave himself, or to think about the problems with one's family and how am I going to solve all of this, or how am I going to sort of fix up this sickness in the body. Those are problems. Those are difficulties. But just to be able just to watch one breath, which is so easy and it's full of contentment. It's amazing. I'm so grateful. I have got like hours where all I have to do is just watch one breath. That's why being a monk is a great job. It's just so simple at times. When it's what I'm supposed to be doing. It's just watching one breath. It's the simplest job in the world and people allow me to do it. Thank you very much. Even praise me for doing it. They feed me for doing it. or just watching one breath. So it's contentment with what you're doing. When you're content with what you're doing, you stay there. Discontent leads to restlessness. So if restlessness comes up into your mind, no, it's because you've developed a fault-finding mind rather than a mind which looks for contentment, which is grateful that you have this one breath to look at. And develop that contentment in the moment. Go out into this retreat center and just be content just with the grass, with the bricks, with the food, with the sunshine. Isn't it wonderful just being here? Isn't it wonderful just being on this mat? Isn't it wonderful just being with this breath? And there you've overcome restlessness. The very refined hindrance of restlessness often comes up right at the end when you get samadhi nimittas coming up. You just can't leave them alone. You just mess around with them. You just can't be content just with the samadhi nimitta as it's appearing right now. You want something more, you get excited. Restlessness is one of those hindrances which can so easily destroy that samadhi nimitta. You've got there already. You don't have to do anything more. Leave it alone. Just be content with it and it will develop by itself. That's what contentment is, just complete laziness. Just sitting here, just watching this samadhi nimitta just blossom into a jhana. You don't do anything. If it takes an hour, if it takes 5 minutes, if it never happens, you're content. That's the way to get into jhanas. Restlessness at that end means the nimitta is not stable. Comes and goes. That's a sign of restlessness in the mind. If you can sustain attention effortlessly, that's the sign that restlessness has been overcome. The last of the hindrances is doubt, vichikicca. Doubt on two areas. First of all, the instructions. What am I supposed to do? And hopefully that it's my job to overcome that aspect of the hindrance. The teacher's job by giving you very clear instructions. So you know exactly what to do when. The path is just very clear. But the biggest doubt with people is, can I do it? Is it possible for me to achieve these things? Am I really cut out for meditation? Other people, yeah, they may be okay, but not me. That doubt is a big hindrance for many meditators. I can't get rid of that doubt for you. I can only give stories like I gave the other night about people like Angulimala, the mass murderer. People like Patachara, who was a case for trauma counselling if ever there was one. All of these people without counselling got into jhanas and got into enlightenment experiences. And they had much more suffering than you've had. If they can do it, you can. So have confidence in yourself. Don't give rise to doubt. It doesn't matter how many years you've been meditating, getting nowhere. Doesn't matter at all. Who was it, I think, Anuruddha, one of the great monks in the time of the Buddha. I think 16 or 17 years, I think it was, before he became fully enlightened. And he was like practicing diligently every day. He was just one of the slow ones. If he can do it, so can you. And it does happen. I've seen this in the years I've been teaching meditation. Sometimes people practice for a long time and they think they're getting nowhere. They think they're getting nowhere. They think they're getting nowhere. But in truth, the seeds are growing under the ground and they just can't see it. And all it takes is one day, 1 hour, one meditation, and the seed pops up above the ground. And to their great surprise, they realize that all these years they've been struggling and thinking they're getting nowhere, they have indeed been getting somewhere. And it gives you confidence, which overcomes doubt.
You can do it, you will do it, it's only a matter of time. So that's how to overcome doubt. You have to believe that there. So that's the talk on the five hindrances, especially the first two, which I spent a lot of time on. Are there any questions about those talks? Yes? Okay. Overcoming the hindrance, does that mean forever or just during your meditation? You overcome them temporarily, first of all. So you get sort of some freedom from them. And you know that you've got freedom from them if you get into deep meditation. And after you emerge from deep meditation, you'll notice that those hindrances are gone for a long time. The mind is very sharp, very still, you can sort of keep attention on one thing a long time, there's no ill will at all, you can't get angry at someone even if they hit you over the head. This is the result of good meditation. But after a while, depending on the depth and the time of that meditation, the hindrances come back again. It's like they've been in a boxing ring, they've just been slugged, and they're unconscious for a while. Eventually they come round again, and then they start playing their tricks again. But at least you know what it's like to have overcome those hindrances. And bit by bit, as you return to those stages more and more, the hindrances get weaker and weaker. The more times they get knocked out, the more sickly they become, the weaker they become. And it's the job of the enlightenment insights to overcome those hindrances once and for all. This is the age-old path of Buddhism. You slug them through this meditation, suppression, to give you the opportunity to get wisdom, to weaken the hindrances, until actually you see through them once and for all, and they're lying there on the ground, and they're done with, and they don't get up again. The hindrances have been completely abandoned, you're enlightened. And if you're enlightened, there's just no difficulty in getting into jhanas. The obstacle's gone. That which is between you and jhanas has been completely eradicated. Does that answer the question? Anyone else got another question they'd like to ask? Going, going, gone. Okay, if you have another question, you can ask it on a piece of paper and put it in the biscuit tin for this evening.